This podcast is brought to you by Formkeep, form endpoints for designers and developers. No iframes, JavaScript embeds, or CSS overrides. Try out our sandbox mode before you buy at formkeep.com.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Sean.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Derek.
Yeah, we're at RailsConf again. We're joined by Sam Saffron. Boy, what's your intro? You work on discourse.
I work on discourse.
Several other things.
He yells about performance a lot.
Yeah.
I guess the intro would be, in a previous lifetime, I worked at Stack Overflow with Jeff, and now I'm working with Jeff at Discourse, and it's a platform for discussion. Idea is that we want to displace PHP BB and make it go away so nobody has to use that.
That's again. A very noble goal. On behalf of the internet world, thank you.
And it's been going great. We've had a lot of opportunities to speed up Rails and make it work better for us. One thing about Discourse is that because we want it to be everywhere, then we have to make sure that anybody can run it.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that low spec'd computers can run this software.
Right.
So that is why we spend a lot of time focusing on making it faster and making it consume less memory, because that allows us to get discourse out everywhere.
Sure.
So the requirements were like 10 gigs of RAM.
So it's an Ember app, right? I mean, what are the challenges associated with making it run on low-end hardware? I'm assuming that that's not just, for an intensive app like this, I'm assuming that's not just something that happens magically.
Well, Ember itself doesn't add anything. It actually removes work from the server, because often you're just doing like API calls, and these API calls don't need to do all of the rendering.
I misunderstood. I thought you meant like the low end machines were the client, not the low end.
No, the low end deploys.
Right, I forgot deploy.
So like for example, you can deploy Discourse quite comfortably on $10 a month. DigitalOcean instance using our magical Docker deploy that is the only supported way of deploying discourse. So yeah, that's what actually for that, and Ember does tie in, it does help us being an API app, because that's another bunch of work that we don't need to do on the server, which is great.
So I feel like I've come across so much of your stuff based on this performance work that you're doing for Ruby, right?
Yeah.
I use these tools and they're very helpful to me, but I feel like I'm very far away from being able to like do this work without your tooling. So how did you, I guess like, was this just out of necessity or is this something you've always done? Were you doing this at Stack Overflow as well?
Yes, actually Rack Mini Profiler was born out of a project in Stack Overflow that mm-hmm. was created by Jared who works there. And that was born out of necessity of not having that tool in .NET. So there's actually a lot of history around profiling. In a previous life, I worked for a company called Altiris that got acquired by Symantec, and I was dealing with a lot of performance issues back then in .NET. So I wrote my own profiling tool, which was closed source, and we shipped with our product, and then it just died eventually and never came back again. And then I vowed that if I'm ever doing any of these things again, it's going to be open source. And that tool was absolutely awesome, but there was no way to use it anymore.
Right.
And then like I got to the website, and I was like, there's no good profiling tool out there. And then Mini Profiler was born. Jared did all the work. I kind of was saying, I need something like this, please. We need something like this.
It's pretty okay.
And
it's adequate.
Yeah, it is adequate. Adequate performance.
An adequate profiler, yes. So what are the areas you're focusing on now? Like, where have you been able to help make significant gains in Rails performance lately?
4.2.
Lately.
Yeah, 4.2 counts as lately.
Well, no, that's what I mean. I mean, like, the fact that 4.2 is not twice as slow as 4.1, I would say that's pretty helpful contribution.
Yeah, look, going forward, it's hard for me to think, you know, I've got these things in the pipeline that I really, really want to do. But
right.
Looking at the history of the last few years, there's been a lot of stuff. And I think the biggest thing that I feel really honored to have participated in was before we released 2.1, we had like this little workforce with me and Koichi and Aman, and we were just talking about what kind of gaps the actually MRI has that is making it hard for us to write all of this tooling. Mm-hmm. And that's when a lot of these APIs were born and added into MRI. And that was really amazing that we managed to land so many patches into MRI. And now it's paying off with all of the memory profiling that was absolutely impossible to do back in the day. Now it's actually a possibility.
Right. When was the API, the C API that makes the sampling profile possible? Was that 2.1?
Yes. So StackProf is... Aman kept rebooting this. Like, if you look at the history of all of Aman's profilers, It was like a new profiler every year that is slightly smarter and slightly using slightly better APIs.
Right.
And it was just evolving year after year after year. And StackProf is the last one in that iteration that is based on the APIs in 2.1.
Okay.
So that was impossible to do without those new APIs. So whenever you hear people using, use StackProf. So yeah, you're bound to use 2.1 and up. And that is thanks to that work that happened before we released 2.1.
Okay.
And gave us the infrastructure to do that.
And that's cool, right? Yeah. And for the listeners, the API that we're talking about was the ability to get the current full stack frame without performing any allocations. That was the main thing that was missing, right?
It was a C-level API
that
allows you to get very efficiently gather stack traces and GC information and whatnot.
Yeah. So, and then in Rails, of course, we shipped RC1, you guys ran your benchmarks, which that's another examples of contributions, right? Having an app that we can easily benchmark against is always good. And
yeah, that has been awesome. And now going forward, I'm mentoring Alan, who's working on Ruby Bench at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working pretty much every week. I chat with him and we talk about what he's doing. And he's a student. He's got limited time, but a lot more time, free time than I have. He's been working on this, plugging away, improving it, making sure that all of our benchmarks are testing valid things.
Right.
And making sure that all of this runs. Ruby Bench is a very interesting project in that it touches so many different things. To be able to run a benchmarking project, you need to know how to provision servers and run Docker containers and write the scripts and write the web. So you have to be this type of person who is comfortable to work on like 100 different things and tie them all together magically and release something.
Right.
So that's why it took us so long to actually get something out there that's live. But now it's live and we're looking for help.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to review the various benchmarks and submit new benchmarks or improve the web UI or improve the automation, we'd love to see that. So definitely I see a lot of that happening in the next 6 months. Hopefully we can help you guys at Rails have regular benchmarks run on every commit.
I actually just got a Ruby Bench issue for a regression. And this one was just the writes got slower in 4.2, which we were talking about yesterday. Yeah. Like, I don't really want to close and just go, yep, I know, sorry, I'm working on it. But definitely stuff like that's really helpful.
And ideally, the closer we can catch it to when you're committing the code, the better it is, right?
Yeah. It's just tricky, right? Because when you're dealing with micro benchmarks, a lot of times the characteristics. So like, for example, creating a new model with zero attributes is slightly slower, but creating a model and assigning attributes got slightly faster, and that was a direct movement of work from one place to another. And then it's just like, okay, so then we have to decide what is the most common case, and I figure the common case is we're going to give some attributes to the model at some point during its lifetime for more cases than not.
So I think the important thing there, the take back, is probably to like contribute a little spec, a little test to Ruby Bench, so we can show that in a picture. Like, yeah, this went a little bit down, but this other one went way up, and this is a more common case.
Right, but that's just the issue, right? Is then when people see one or the other in isolation, it can draw a very different picture.
Yeah,
that
definitely
doesn't necessarily give the entire
picture. Yeah, you still need to do some, what do they call it?
Macro benchmarks?
Or you just need to, do some editorializing on top of the benchmarks, right? Like, a little bit.
Sure.
Where you see, these two went down, these three went up. Which ones are more likely? And then, and then you need, the macro benchmark on top. It's that does prove us out that this is something more.
And I think the Rails benchmarks that are getting added have at least one that's just, a full app, right? A pretty simple, I think it's, a simple blog or something.
Yeah, I think at the moment we've been focusing on just active records, right?
Okay, I'm fine with that.
So I want to get that done first because I feel that most of the performance issues that Rails developers have these days are all related to Active Record and Active Record overhead.
Sorry.
It's just where, but you know what? Like any web app, whenever you look at it, it's all DB stuff, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at how long it took to render your page, 50% DB, and that's normal. Mm-hmm. So you need to like spend a lot of time there because that's where all of the time is going to be. And you want to minimize the overhead between what the actual raw execution of SQL is to getting objects at the other end.
Right. I mean, you can also kind of infer that Active Record would be where most of these issues are going to live. Just if you run WC-L on our code base, right, I think Rails as a whole is 270-something, and Active Record is 210 of those.
Yeah.
Thousands, that is. Active Record is 210 lines of code.
It's now a micro
awesome.
Framework. Oh, man, I wish. But yeah, it's just like when it's that big of a percentage of our code base.
And you can't change a lot of things, right? You're married to certain implementations and hacks and methods that can't really ever change. Or
yeah, I mean, we do pride ourselves on not like stagnating for backwards compatibility reasons. Like we're never going to have a MySQL real escape string type of deal. But at the same time, you just have to weigh like this is going to cause somebody a lot of pain if I change or remove this. Is that worth the gains? And it's always just a case-by-case thing, right? If there is a case where it's like, if I could change this, and it's going to be really painful for everybody, but it's going to make Rails twice as fast across the board,
yeah,
I'll probably still get shot down, but I'll try.
So you mentioned Discourse Bench, which is like the benchmarks you have for Discourse, the whole full-stack application, basically,
that is
right?
Correct.
Do you think that's something that, like, did you guys invest time in that up front? Do you think that's something all apps should do?
Maybe. That's it's a difficult question. All apps should be gathering performance metrics somehow. So definitely if you've got some production like app that you care about and it's making you money, you should definitely have some graph somewhere, be it Graphite or New Relic or whatever it is that you do. You should have something. Skylight. So definitely, whether you roll your own or use something, you should have something. And that is more important, I think, than spending the time on writing your macro benchmark.
Okay.
But the macro benchmark itself, if you're big enough and you can afford to invest the time, it's something you can chuck into CI, and then you can catch like certain macro regressions.
Then you know the cause.
Very quickly, right. Close to the commits or the gem update that you did.
Right.
And you can catch some of that in production, right? Because you still got those graphs in production when you deploy the code, but it's a little bit further down the line and easier to forget. And also you can automate, like if you had a macro benchmark, you can say, yeah, if it goes more than 20% slower, then just revert the commit. That commit's not allowed. Mm-hmm. So you can actually stop this stuff from ever even getting into production.
I mean, that requires a dedicated CI machine though, right? Yeah. Like that, you couldn't do that with Travis.
No.
But you could fail the build and then, if as long as you don't merge failed builds.
Well, no, but my point being, like, there would be too much variance unless you had a known dedicated
machine.
Like
on Travis. Yes.
You need actual dedicated hardware to do that.
Right.
Because on Travis, you have no idea what's going to happen.
What I find is, like, when I look at New Relic stuff, because the only time I ever look it up is, like, I set it up. That's great. And I'm making sure it's recording data. I'm like, good. We got data. This is what I've got. Fantastic. And then somebody reports a problem a few months later where it's, like, we're seeing bad performance somewhere. So I dive into it. And at that point, I feel like it's almost too late because I don't know. Now I'm divorced from it. I don't know what the baseline is. And I can look.
Yeah.
And sometimes it is like, oh, we did this one thing and there's a huge jump. But oftentimes it's just like there's a little bit of a rise and then a little jump and then a little bit of a rise. And it's not one thing. It's just several small things.
Well, one thing is that I've done like back from the Stack Overflow days is that it's in my DNA to always look at performance. So if I'm using any app, I'll always have Mini Profiler enabled in production for me. And then as I'm browsing around, I see these little numbers that tell me, you know, this is how long it took to render this page. On every little thing that I'm doing, if I post a reply, I'll see the number of how long it took to do that. So by having that kind of constant live feedback, it's something that you will notice a lot earlier than just somebody coming to you, because you're used to it.
Right, and you know the baseline because you're seeing it all the time.
You're seeing it all the time, right. And then it seems weird when it's not acting like that. And also it kind of entices you to say, oh, yeah, this just took 400 milliseconds. Or this just took a second. Let's have a quick peek inside and see what did that. Oh, I'm running 300 queries to render this page that everybody's going to. Like, because you can't really notice just with the timer in your head that a page is taking half a second versus 200 milliseconds. It's one of those, it's a subtle feeling, like that when it becomes really a lot faster, you'll notice it. And you go, oh, wow, something is really snappy about this. But as it's happening and you're used to it, you just get used to it, right? And you're not so having a number really helps, and knowing what number you can work down to helps.
I don't think I've ever enabled it in production. Like, I have it in development, and sometimes you see like weird outliers in development and you're just like, eh, server restarted, no big deal.
Yeah,
like something like that, you're like, ah, that wasn't a big deal.
The assets recompiled, you know.
Yeah, so I hadn't thought about enabling it in production for like admin users or something like
that. that's how it was designed. Like, that was the first goal of it was to use it in production, and then development came more after that, which is kind of interesting.
Okay. I think I'm going to have to try that.
Yeah. Sounds like a good idea.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned, you know, for example, one of the things that's pretty common is like, ooh, I ran 300 queries to run this page. I think part of that's like Rails has certain APIs that can not necessarily encourage you to make poor performance choices, but like an N plus one queries bug just isn't a thing in most other languages.
Oh, no. N plus one is super common.
Well, okay, I'm talking like you go back to the PHP days, though, right? And we're just doing our SQL queries in our markup. Like, if you're doing a query in a loop, it's a lot more obvious because you're executing the query.
Well, the abstraction definitely is hiding stuff from you. But as an error, like, it's the general problem is that a lot of times we think imperatively about these problems when it's actually all set theory, right?
Right.
So in a lot of developers don't have a good grasp of set theory and like why it's so much more efficient to do, you know, two queries on one page than 200. And it's not only that it just happens in one chunk, it's that all of the little bits of work, they add up to more work than just doing it in one in one go. So that's, I think, something that causes this across the board, that people just, you know, they just want to put the loop, the while loop, and they don't want to write a query that will just, you know, go through the whole set of data and fix it up or move it or query it.
I actually feel like once you know to look for N plus one queries, Rails is a pretty good story on how to fix it. Like, you do includes and then you tell it what you want to include, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's not terrible. It's something you have to know and something you have to be aware of, but
there's a handful of places where there actually isn't a solution.
Right, and it gets hard. Like, I know at one point, I think, on like the app that we worked on together, like, we had a couple of places where we were like, well, of course, when you have a post, you're always going to want its comments, so let's just put that in the default scope. And like, when you say, let's do anything in the default scope, it's like, oh, wait, this impacts way more than you think it impacts. Like,
yeah.
So don't use default scope, I guess.
We have default scoping at Discourse, which is because we don't allow for any hard deletes. All deletes have to be soft deletes. So whenever you're looking at a site, you're always looking at minus the deleted rows. Yep. And I can't really think of another structure outside of default scopes that allows you to do it very simply.
You'd always have to have like an implicit scope that you call. Like, you couldn't just call like posts.all or anything like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Like posts.not deleted.
Yeah.
It depends on how you define like simply, because I mean the alternative would be something like paper trail, right? Where you just store the diffs in a completely separate table and then expose an interface to allow you to like go find all the deleted stuff, and that's certainly more complicated in terms of like it's not just a Boolean on your table. But
yeah, but I don't want to chuck the data out because then I need to query it in the same format for admins that see deleted stuff. So I'm like kind of...
That's useful. Like we're admins on our Discourse forum. It's useful to see like, oh, this got deleted.
But yeah. and certainly it'd be slower to query it. But that said, if something only ever appears on an admin page, that's a little bit less bad.
Yeah, I guess.
But it doesn't. It appears like right in the regular UI, right?
Yeah.
Oh, well, never mind.
The thing that's interesting, like if I was to solve this in SQL, I'd just create a view, right, without the deleted, and just always select from that view. So it would be kind of interesting if there was some kind of mechanism in Rails to say, yeah, if you're doing read, then go to this view by default.
Yeah.
And then that could possibly avoid needing to do like some of that logic. elsewhere.
You can definitely use a view. Like, Rails will just see it as a table. This guy maintains a gem for this.
Yeah, it's in early stages, but it lets you define views and, like, kind of get migration-like behavior in that, like, you define a view file, and it creates a migration for you, and then it versions that view file a lot like you would version a migration with a date stamp. I think it just does a numeric increase or whatever. So you don't get in these situations where, like, you're constantly editing the same file, or you have to, like, copy and paste the definition for the previous version of your view into your down migration, like, trying to handle some of that. But there's still, like, resistance, I feel like, whenever I'm like, we could use a view for this. People are like, well, does Rails do that well? I'm like, actually, yeah, it does. It does it really well.
And we could make it so that you could specify a view specifically for read and then hit the table for write. So that should be announced for Rails 5. No, that should be really trivial to add.
Yeah, because it would be a way to, like, switch out of needing to use default scopes, which would be cool.
Yeah, def table name for read, def table name for write, just have them default to table name by default, no backwards compatibility.
Because, yeah, in write, you don't really
care about
it. I'll
do that right now. We're done. Yeah. It's great.
Yeah, we're done. Derek just did it. We just committed it. We pushed it. Yeah, no, we can do that.
Cool. Excellent. We're winning.
What are you excited about working on right now? What are you really looking into?
Really looking into? A lot of the DevOps stuff is stuff that's really close to me at the moment because we're accruing a lot of customers and we need to manage all of this. So if I look at the last few weeks, I've spent a lot of time on getting a Graphite, Grafana. Grafana is a very cool tool. Like, definitely put it in the show notes and people should have a look at it. And that allows us to do graphing of all the performance that's going on in our huge cluster of machines, and we can see basically what the performance on various pages, what memory is doing, and so on. And I spent a lot of time kind of making this into something that anybody could install as a Docker container, so anybody can get this now if they want to. So I see a lot of stuff exciting around, like, that kind of ops, DevOps stuff that involves writing source code to get the DevOps to happen,
right?
Which is new.
The interesting thing about Discourse, right, is so you talked about, like, there's this Docker deployment thing that you support, but then you also do a lot of hosting as well, right?
Yes.
That's kind of the preferred way, I imagine, or it's easier for you, right, if everybody hosts?
It's easier and harder because we have a customer that we need to support and
keep happy. But like, my question was going to be, like, when you start shipping software to somebody else to deploy, now you've got upgrade, like, things that you can't control?
No, I can. That's the reason that we're using Docker.
Okay.
The same way that we deploy internally is exactly the same way anybody deploys.
Right.
So for me, one thing that started happening in the last year is, like, I totally don't believe in having signatures in forums, like, where you write your post and then you have a signature telling you to do something. But, like, the general troubleshooting issue of anybody has any kind of vague issue with Discourse, I'm like, yeah, dot launch a rebuild app, right? So just throw away your old container that probably has got a few bugs and I didn't do properly and whatever, and take in the new one and it fixes all the things and bring in the latest code. And when you think about container, you're not just thinking about the Rails code. It's how Nginx is configured.
Exactly.
It's how, like, it's the whole deployment. And that's a brave new world where, like, you've got this magic reset
switch. You're basically
just
saying, deploy the server, and you're done, I guess, right? I mean, I guess the lone trip up there would be, like, database stuff that happens, right?
Yeah, so that's what I was going to get into.
Go ahead.
Well, no, just because, like, this is an example of a use case that we haven't been considering enough in the past where, like, with the migration API, and specifically with changes in the migration API, which you guys get hurt by it more than anybody else, right? Because
We're pretty adamant on running SQL where we have to run SQL and not, like, reaching out to too many features. The only big change, I guess, was the way indexes work changed a little bit, and that kind of hurt
us
a
little bit. Or, like, timestamps changing from not null to null.
Yes.
And just, but that's the thing. It's the little things like that, right?
Yeah.
And it's fine for most apps because normally it's like you write a migration, you run it on your machine, your other devs run it on their machine, presumably within a week or two, and then, like, if a new dev comes on, you run schema RB, which is always a current snapshot. But you guys now have a scenario where it's actually kind of reasonable if they go, let's say, three versions forward of Discourse, the first one added a migration, the second one changed the version of Rails, and the third one added another migration, right? Then that you're now in a scenario where it's reasonable that a migration would be run against a version of Rails of them for what it was written.
I don't know. Like, we control the whole stack, so we can take care of that particular problem to a degree. But what I'd do is add an extra migration on top of it to, like, normalize.
Yeah.
Right. Which is what I'd recommend. Instead of making the migration subsystem more complicated, a simpler way is just to clean up the data. And, you know, if you need to make this super trivial for people, then you could just provide a helper that just clean up this mess that this used to be not null and now it's null or whatever.
So that's interesting because I've definitely seen some talk, and it made sense to me, around like finding a way to indicate in a migration or in the migration file name, I think, is one of the considerations.
Yeah, that's what we're going on right now. Is
like what the version of Rails this migration is for?
Yeah, and then if nothing else, just flat out, like, printing a warning or, like, failing unless you add a flag or something like that, saying, like, hey, this was written against a different version of Rails. This might have unexpected behavior. Going too much farther than that requires us to basically have parts of our code base maintain every behavior change that we've ever introduced to the migration API, and that might potentially mess up refactoring.
I do feel like that warning is just going to become, like, noise. Like, you're going to get that every time that you upgrade Rails, right? So, like, now I've got to decide.
But you don't normally run migrations against different versions of Rails.
Developers do. Right.
No, like, you write a migration and then you run it. Unless you, like, also upgraded Rails that same
day.
But
I also drop my database and remigrate often. I don't necessarily pull from schema.
We always run the full migration chain.
Really?
Yes.
That's not recommended.
I know it's not recommended, but I always want to be able to recreate the production state of the database from the migrations if I can.
The thing is, that's what we're doing in production. So doing it in development is probably a saner thing. So and also, because we use SQL, or in the past we had to use SQL for certain features, like, for example, full text indexes didn't exist, and filtered indexes didn't exist until they were added. So we were using all of those features, and you'd run an exec to get that. So pulling the schema out and just from the migration definition is practically impossible. Then you have to suck it out of the database. But doing that, then developers are developers and will be developers and will muck with the database. And then just checking in a file that is unclean and not easy to generate.
Yeah.
Right. So
You get to the point where, like, you're battling. Like, I check in one version of schema RB.
Oh,
there are no changes. You check it. There are no database changes. Somehow you have a different schema RB, and you're like, I don't know what happened here. Let me check this in. And, like, we're just battling over each other about which version of schema RB.
Yeah, and schema RB is easy compared to what structure.sql, which is the other one.
When we have to switch to structure.sql, we often just ignore it.
Yeah.
Because, like, the diff here is impossible to read. It's not valuable. Let's forget about it.
I do think one thing that can help prevent us from having to go to structure.sql more often is just if we add I'm thinking about adding a method that's just like execute the SQL and store it in a place so that gets dumped into schema RB.
How?
In one of our special Rails tables.
So you'd have like exec statements, but how do you chain them in the correct order?
Yeah, the order would be interesting.
Insert order? Yeah, they'd just be an order of insertion to where we're storing them.
I don't know if that would work. Because the actual schema itself shows up first. I don't know how you'd have to know
what version. Correctly. I guess you could store the version of the migration it's in, right?
Yeah.
But then, like, if a migration has a create table and then it has one of these special execs, the migration might have also been special exec create table.
You'd need to know.
I gotcha. Yeah, you'd have to fold everything. Yeah.
You need to have multiple schema RBs basically, and then you run the things between those schema RBs.
I bet we could.
This sounds so much simpler.
I bet it could be. I bet it's possible.
Yeah, I mean,
you could say like that one of these special execs has to be in a migration on its own, and then therefore you know its version and you know when to like link when to run it in.
But what is schema RB buying you? Like, why do you want that?
It's a prettier file than structure.sql.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you can annotate your models.
Merge conflicts are a lot easier.
What do you mean, merge conflicts?
Right, but we were talking, like, why
not
just ignore it?
Why do you need it at all? Why not just run all of the migrations? Like, what is it buying you to have that one file with all of the schema?
It's a little bit faster.
Well,
That's about it.
And it insulates you better from when we do change the migration DSL. Like when we change the behavior, because the behavior of those methods...
Provided all of the old migrations have run, which they haven't if your code is deployed in everywhere in the world.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Is like that's why we don't consider... Because the normal model is the Basecamp, right? You have development, and you have one production instance, or maybe some staging servers, but they get run immediately.
Right. And I think David's point is, like, you don't run those migrations again. But I am of the camp that, oh, like, yeah, I'm constantly running the migrations again. So it's common for me when Rails migrations change to go through and be like, I've got to update all these migrations. Like, I edit old migrations because I have to get them to run.
Yeah, sometimes we try to avoid it. Like, we never reach into models, for example, in
right,
a migration.
Right, we don't do any of that. Right.
So
because that model helps. Name might be gone at that yeah. point.
The other thing that I've been toying with is naming indexes, because
Rails
is,
keeps changing how they're going to name them.
Yeah, and like I want to have a consistent database schema, and that becomes, first of all, it's a nightmare for Rails if they change the rules to ever figure out how to like fix them in a backwards compatible way. Yeah. So I'm kind of thinking maybe I should just name my indexes and like forget about this problem. Like, how much extra work is that adding?
I think at one point, during one version, I had like Rails, when you renamed a column, didn't rename the indexes.
Yeah,
there and then the next version, like they changed that. Yeah. And then like I had migrations that were like, in the meantime, I was like, oh, I'm bugged by these index names being wrong. So I
wrote
migrations.
Well, then it's also, if you ever try and remove the index, we yeah. can't find it.
Right. So it's like, so that was a disaster. But these things are pain points for like the first few months after migration, and everybody kind of forgets about it, and then they come back again.
Well, that, but that's more like, so you go in and you guys think about this. Most people don't, and it's just yeah. painful.
But that's isn't that like to a degree any API that is encouraging huge amounts of magic is going to have that
yes.
problem at some point.
I agree with that statement.
Do you think migrations are magic?
I think parts of it are magic.
The schema RB part might be magic. Like the dumping is probably magic.
Add index is magic.
Yeah.
When do you ever do create index without giving it a name when you're writing in SQL directly?
Oh, you don't. Right.
So then
it's going to infer the name, right?
Why did they come up with that? Why didn't they allow for unnamed create indexes in SQL? Like, and if you think back, then you think that like that name is actually very important.
Right.
Because that is something that you'll use for diagnostics. If you're analyzing your actual execution plan,
right.
then you'll get that name there, and like right. there's use for it. So,
but it does do a good job at giving a pretty a good name. I feel like yeah, at least it's consistent. Like
it gives it all of the names of the columns, right?
Right, and it That's also, but it idea. Also like it also tells you like it's like named in a consistent fashion. Right. Whereas like when I've worked on raw SQL, where we do raw SQL migrations, right?
Yeah.
Like some people name their things IDX underscore.
IDX like, awesome.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, it's like they're like, I should see this in query plan, you know? Yeah. And like somehow that sticks around. You're like, okay, that doesn't tell me anything. But
yeah,
so that has that nicety to it. But yeah, you're probably right that maybe there's a reason they didn't allow for that in regular ANSI SQL.
And I'm not saying like it's. There are certainly worse cases of magic, but if you do like TDOT belongs to whatever, polymorphic true, index true, foreign key true, like...
Yeah, oh, that is
the
enormous amounts of magic.
Yeah, the polymorphic thing. Yeah.
Right now it's at least explicit, but yeah, I wouldn't mind having to create the two columns. I mean, of course mm-hmm. I can just create the two columns specifically, but that's kind of why I've been, and I think ultimately I'm going to lose this in the long run, but I'm against the idea of ever changing the behavior of these methods. And when we do need to add new behavior, we add new options, and we can yeah. change the generators. If we want timestamps to be null false by default, we should change the generators to generate null false by default.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than adding, you know, just having it be explicit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I once worked on a system where like they didn't allow Rails migrations. You had to run migrations in this thing that they invented, which was Postgres migrations, basically.
Yeah.
But it was fine. It was exactly like yeah. Rails migrations, and you just wrote raw SQL.
Yeah.
And it was fine. And it solved the problem where, like, if you do get in a situation where you need to roll back, you have to remember to roll back, then roll back, do DB rollback, then roll back your code. Because if you roll back the code, you cannot roll back the database because that migration no longer exists.
Yeah.
Like, so it solved that problem by separating the two systems. And writing raw SQL wasn't bad. Like,
I like this.
You like this? Is that what you said?
Yes. I mean, the one of the nice things that our API does do, though, is it's able to infer how to roll back most actions.
Yeah, when the change stuff came in, that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
It lets you write less. It's a question of, you know, how much you don't want to repeat yourself, right?
Right. And we're taking it so far.
And does it, yeah, and how far are we willing to go in the don't repeat yourself thing? Like, at the end, it'll just be do magic.
Right. And I think some of the early part of migrations was like, look, you can write it in this way, and you don't have to worry about how you write it in MySQL and how you write it in Postgres. But I think people are finding over years that, like, that doesn't matter
yeah,
that much.
Like, I don't know. There's this mythical person that needs to run their app on both MySQL and Postgres that exists somewhere. But,
I've done one conversion from MySQL to Postgres.
It used to be common,
still had to be
SQLite in development.
Yeah, that's true. It did, but that was a bad idea.
It was a really bad idea.
Terrible idea.
But it used to be common.
Made possible by the migrations, right? So, like, if the migrations didn't exist, people wouldn't have done that bad idea.
But yeah, no, I mean, like, you don't actually change your database. I am opposed to the idea that Active Record is actually attempting, I mean, it may have been in the past, but the idea that it is or should be attempting to abstract you from the database to the point where you can actually switch vendors is nonsense. And if you're not doing anything with your database specific to that database, you're not doing anything interesting with your database, and you probably should be.
Well, or it could also just mean if you're not doing anything particularly interesting, the raw SQL you were going to write is also equally compatible. Like, maybe you have a couple small tweaks to syntax here and there, which I'm not remembering right now, but, like, not a big deal at all.
Yeah, I mean, they all support ANSI okay-ish.
Plus, minus. No, in Postgres, you tend to use a lot of Postgres-ish features just because, you know, they added JSON. Let's start
once you get into that
JSON,
territory.
Let's start doing that. And it's a lot of very, very cool features that they have that are handy. Like, if you don't know that you're using a database and you just abstract it away, it's like you're just not tapping into all of this. Mm-hmm. And it can help you a lot in certain cases. And I find SQL most powerful and needed, and something that we all kind of need to follow, is in migrations when you have to migrate data. Mm-hmm. Because often, like, and I've had a few of these, like, you make this structure change, but you need to now transform this huge amount of data from this spot to that spot and move it around and meld it and whatnot. And that's what SQL is like phenomenal at, right?
Yep.
Yeah, like you're adding a unique index, right? And now somehow you got non-unique values in that table. How are you going to deal with that, right? And the solution is you write a SQL statement, and probably a SQL statement that's very, very Postgres specific to be able to do that, because the way of doing these deletes with the joins and and whatnot is very, very Postgres specific to the syntax, because a lot of that isn't properly defined.
Right.
Do you read the development blog from Elo at all?
No.
So they had some very interesting problems where the way they set up their activity feed, they made this decision early on to make sharding later easier, where instead of actually going to a table that has the stream, when you perform an action, it instead creates a record for every person that is following you. And then they have their version of MySpace Tom. So every single user follows the system bot or whatever, and they announce downtime or whatever. And that actually, the ability to send out just an announcement from this account drove a lot of their scaling problems. and one of the issues they had was just a column that really should have been indexed wasn't.
Yes.
But then the volume of data was so fast, the index would never complete.
Yeah, that's really hard. Back at Stack Overflow, we had those problems as well of creating an index. And there were all sorts of weird tricks that we'd do, like pull the table, rename it, then make the change on that rename table, and then push it back in and hold off activity. Like, there were all sorts of insane kind of workarounds. But when you've got enormous amounts of load, like it becomes very hard to do some of these things.
And eventually, you just need to stop new data coming in, right?
Yeah.
And it might not necessarily mean actual site downtime, but certainly like you just said, like, stop certain forms of activity while the index builds.
Or move it, I mean, ideally, like, you could move it to read-only mode somehow, and then do the change on a different table and then bring it back. I think you're allowed to have read-only connections in Postgres.
I didn't know that. It's cool.
So you could potentially
Have a user that's read-only, right?
Yeah, definitely do that.
Yeah. Should we wrap up?
Yeah. You got anything else? Anything you want to plug?
Yeah, definitely.
Go.
Plug stuff.
Let's plug Message Bus, because that needs some plugging.
Yes.
Okay.
So
tell us about it.
So we've all heard about Action Cable that is going to be shipping in Rails 5.
Yeah, I'm going to subscribe to it and get TNT, the Action Channel.
Awesome. So Message Bus is the a Ruby gem that we use at Discourse that gives us long polling support, and it's built into Rails. You don't carry any extra dependencies of services, so it just hooks into your Rails app as middleware, and that means that you don't need to worry about any complicated installation things. The dependencies it adds is Redis, which most of us do have, and it uses Event Machine at the moment, but I do plan to allow this to use Celluloid and other things. And what that does, I guess, in a nutshell, is allows you to kind of broadcast a message from your servers and make sure that all the clients get that whenever they want it. And the features that it have that make it particularly interesting is that it's got this catch-up feature. So if you've subscribed to a channel and then you close your laptop and then you open it up a day later, the actual internals will figure out how to catch up on all of the messages that you missed during that window. And that is very handy when you're kind of streaming information to the client and you want to make sure that it got all of that information and you don't want to have to force it to like do full refreshes to figure out what happened or diff the entire page and so on.
So you said this is long polling. Is there a reason that that's preferable to WebSockets?
Well, initially we did try WebSockets and we were having all sorts of issues around HTTP with WebSockets. The thing is there are just so many different flavors of WebSockets. At least there were 2 years ago, all of these draft after draft. This is how you do the frame, the eight different framing protocols and so on. So different browsers behaved a little bit differently, but eventually we accepted that, you know, certain people just can't use WebSockets and they're going to have to upgrade to a new browser. But the thing that kind of made me stop using it was that even on the most modern browsers, it stopped working under HTTP. And that was when you're running via a proxy. A lot of proxies will completely destroy WebSocket traffic. And in a way that is very, very hard to understand what is going on, because you'll connect and the proxy will tell you that you connected and you'll send messages, but nothing's coming through the channel. And at that point, it was like, no, I was in a situation where I couldn't debug this. There was no way of debugging these things in production. I just found out that my phone carrier does this and like all sorts of course, every airplane trip will do this. And I was like, yeah, I don't need this complexity. And then I thought, I took a step back and I thought, you know, what really is this WebSocket stuff buying me?
Well, it's a buzzword.
And the long polling itself, you know, you get one GET request every 30 seconds to a minute, depending what you define. And so it's pretty much a very similar amount of data is moving around. It's just using, you know, traditional HTTP 1.1 supported mechanisms to do. And it falls back beautifully as well, right? So if long polling doesn't work, polling works fine, right? Because as I was saying, the protocol is reliable, so it can catch up at any point in time. And because of that concept that it can catch up at any point in time, you can do polling, right? Because if you missed a message between polls, you'll just catch up at the next poll.
So would this be like a solution for like when I'm using Trello and I close my laptop and I come back and I open it back up? When I'm using it, there's like a thing up on the top right that's like, you need to reload. You've been disconnected for too long.
Oh, no. Right? Yeah, that doesn't happen at Discourse.
Okay. So like this, because of this type of thing, right?
Because of this. That's right.
Okay. Interesting.
And I think that technology is very, very interesting. And it's easy to layer WebSockets on top. But the thing that I'm reluctant to do is like, what is it buying me? What am I going to gain out of it?
I'm going to get pain because...
I'm going to get buzzword compliant. Like, nobody has gone and said, look at these numbers. Look how much faster WebSockets are, right? Nobody's gone and done that work. And that's kind of...
I guess it's performance overhead, possibly, right?
Yeah, I was going to say,
have a
like,
lot
if you're
of
Google
polling,
scale,
if you have a
maybe.
Lot of polling clients.
And we're all going to be Google scale.
Yeah,
we
of
all
course.
Like to we are. We're all going to be rich, and we're all going to be Google scale.
Right.
So, yeah.
But at some point, like, if you're going to be Google scale... I'm not sure if these solutions even fit you. Like, you're going to be stuck writing your own things. Well, GitHub, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, Charlie ended up having to write their own little C-based WebSocket thingy, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, if you're going to get, like, super high scale, then that's it. But, I mean, did somebody come up and say, look at these benchmarks. Look how much faster it's going to be. Look how much better it's going to be. And... it's not faster, it's not better. The code that's the actual code, the amount of code that you need to make this work is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And like you can say, no, that's no problem. There are these abstractions I can use.
We have
and
Action Cable.
This for me. So yeah. Or Action Cable says, that's not a problem. Faye WebSockets does all of this for me. But still, at the bottom, there is a lot of code to drive this and a lot of stuff that needs to be maintained and a lot of stuff going forward, like HTTP2 is going to come. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to add all of those new protocols in there as well. So
what you're saying
I'm
is complex
sure.
dependencies are bad.
Yeah, I mean, they're great, but you have to show that they're actually giving you some gain, right?
Sure.
And that's the frustrating thing. Has anybody gone and benchmarked this and told us, look, you know, we're using this because it's going to be 50% faster or 80% less network traffic? And releasing it without a fallback to me sounds crazy, right? At Discourse, we can actually cool down on the amount of time that we do the polling. So if you move your browser to the background, we detect that the browser is no longer in the foreground, and we tell the message bus, look, chill out. Like, this is all automatic. You just install the gem and you get this.
Right.
But it just says, yeah, cool down, only notify it once a minute. And you haven't done that for a while, only notify it every 5 minutes now, right? Mm-hmm. So you can just cool down on your network traffic a lot with that. Whereas with WebSockets, you're stuck having the WebSocket open and running keep-alives regularly just in case your channel decides to hang because... And it's funny because there are two levels of keep-alives, right? You've got TCP keep-alives that are already running in the background, and then you put another keep-alive on top of that to keep that alive. Sure, right? If this is going to make it like 10 times faster and 10 times more scalable, then I'd be much more comfortable, but I'm not seeing any numbers that prove this except that we want to be buzzword compliant and we want to push the web forward and like
so you're putting message buses like an alternative as something that's like usable today, doesn't
usable
have these
today,
problems,
been working in production now for 2 years,
right,
and is actively developed
and ended up being the way because of ways that you had pain with WebSockets.
Exactly.
So, interesting.
All right,
cool. Anything else?
So yeah, I already plugged Rack Mini Profiler. Only last gem that I'd like to plug is Logster, which is definitely worth...
I haven't heard that one. That one.
So if you go to logster.info, you can put it in the show notes.
Yep.
And that's basically a web UI to look at your logs in both development and production. So in development, it has every log message and with an attached stack trace next to the log message so you can see where that string was generated. In production, it goes warning and up, and it'll give you a row per warning that you get. Cool. And for me, I find it incredibly handy that, like, now if I go to any Discourse instance in the world and I'm an admin, I can go to logs and see...
Right. Where are my deprecations or whatever?
What errors there are there.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks, Sam. That's great.
It's a pleasure. Awesome. Had a great time. Thanks, guys.
Should we wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/17.
Thanks again to our guest, Sam Saffron. As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, feedback on this episode or any other, you can tweet us at @_bikeshed, email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm, or leave feedback on the website.
Thanks for listening to The Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.